It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In 2015, Bayer Material Science spun off from Bayer and became known as Covestro. It's now one of the world's largest makers of polymers for automobiles, furniture, electronics, and other products. Then just last month, Covestro announced it was purchasing Bayer's 260-acre campus in Robinson Township. What does this mean for the company's future in Pittsburgh? Joining me in studio is Håkan Johnson, president of Covestro, and on January 1st, he became chairman as well. Håkan, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
It was this time last year that Bayer announced it was closing down its regional offices in Robinson. That left a lot of questions about that site. What does Covestro's purchase signal now?
It signals that we are going to stay in the same place that we have been for the last 60 years. Pittsburgh's been our home, as I said, for a very long time now, and we were very happy to be able to do the purchase, and so we can secure our future here also.
And the purchase is official when?
We will maybe expect it to close on the deal at the end of December 2020, so the end of this year.
Mm-hmm. The company's announcement suggested that this announcement puts a stake in the ground for Covestro. What do you mean by that?
It means that the community here and this spot has served us very well. You know, Pittsburgh is very close to many of our significant customers. You know, within a couple of hours of drive or maybe a couple of hours in the plane, we can reach a big proportion of our strategic customers. Mm-hmm. We have good collaborations here with universities, for example, world class universities like Carnegie Mellon University. We also have a collaboration with the workers for as lab technicians, right? Mm-hmm. For example, with the Manchester Bidwell Center.
Now, you have sites worldwide, I believe, like 17,000 employees worldwide, somewhere around that figure?
That's correct.
So what about Pittsburgh? Are you hoping to grow Pittsburgh?
Well, let me first say a little bit what we do have here, right? And so Pittsburgh, as I said, that is the North American headquarters. Also, we have a big, it's one of the three, I'd say, one of the three major R&D centers we have globally. So there's a big focus on R&D here, technical development. We manage our customers out of here, and it's also headquarters for our supply chain.
In that same announcement, you mentioned building the future in Pittsburgh. Could that mean more hiring? Is that still down the line, maybe?
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, I think that we have pretty much the workforce that we need now for the foreseeable future. However, since we now own the site, we're going to take a look at how can we strategically use this in the best possible way. Mm-hmm. And so we will look at, the site is quite sizable. It's 15 some buildings and a little bit more than 250 acres. Mm-hmm. We don't need all of that, but we are already looking at how can we strategically best use it. And for the portion that we do not need, we will then make that available for, we will probably sell it and then make it available for further development. And that, of course, could then make the Robinson site very dynamic.
What kinds of talent does your company look for, especially in this region, for what it offers?
We look for a very diverse workforce. And then when I say diverse, I mean from all aspects of diversity. Because we certainly believe that diversity feeds diversity in thinking, feeds the best possible innovation. And we employ engineers, we employ chemists, we employ business majors, we know lawyers. But as I mentioned also before, we do also employ lab technicians, right? So we have the whole gamut. But what we do need, we need world-class talent in all of those areas. And we have got world-class talent for the last 60 years coming out of the Pittsburgh region.
Well, let me ask you more about the diversity. You mentioned some of the jobs and the duties, but what about the demographic diversity? What steps do you take to do that, to be more inclusive as a company?
Well, first of all, we need to make sure that there's a diverse a group of people that knows about Covestro, right? So we gotta promote ourselves. So we go and we do recruit at fairs directed to underrepresented parts of the population. As I said, diversity in its broadest sense. So that is getting a good base. But then also once people come to apply to us, we use diverse panels for the interviewing, you know, so making sure that we have diverse talent, diverse candidates, but then also have diverse opinions about who is the optimal candidate for that job.
Can you find the talent you need, the potential employees that you require? Can you find them here?
Yes. Up to now, I would say that we have certainly been able to find the talent that we need. Of course, as we all know, that you know, Pittsburgh can also improve its diversity in certain aspects, and that is a reflection also on our workforce. But I would say that so far so good, but we are obviously very supportive of making Pittsburgh even more diverse.
Our guest on The Confluence is Håkan Johnson, president and chairman of Covestro. You began your career with Bayer in 1992 as a scientist here in Pittsburgh. You're now president and chairman of Covestro. Do you still get a chance to explore that creative, inventive side of the business?
Officially not, right? But as I said, I guess I'll try to sneak into the lab when I can to see what the developments are. With my background, though, as I said, I spent a lot of time in R&D or innovation or business development or manufacturing. So I do understand how you invent our products, and I understand how we produce them, right? But unfortunately, I don't get to spend that much time there, but I'm always looking for all the opportunities to do so, right? Because that is what really excites me.
You're originally from Sweden. Are you a hockey fan by chance?
I am a very big hockey fan. Growing up in Sweden, everyone is interested in hockey. I did play a little bit, but I realized soon that that's not where I was going to make a living. So
how are you mixing your fascination with innovation and your fandom for hockey, say in your partnership with the Penguins?
Yes, that is something that we are very proud of. You know, the collaboration we have, the partnership. We are the official innovation partner of the Pittsburgh Penguins. And that has been a very good source of joint activities, sometimes also with other partners. For example, our Rethink the Rink activities, where the two of us partnered up with CMU to have an innovation event on how we can do the sport of ice hockey safer.
And, well, the Penguins' leading scorer this season, Jake Guentzel, goal scorer, seriously injured his shoulder and is out for up to 6 months after sliding violently into the dasher boards behind the goal last month. You're actually working on a project involving the dasher boards. What's the update on that?
Yeah, that actually the Rethink the Rink event in 2018, we had an activity where we were looking at how can we make the dasher board safer. We have continued to work on that, and actually, together with a Canadian manufacturer of dasher boards, we have a prototype that has been tested, and for first a little module, but it was successfully tested. And later this year, there will be dasher boards of that type installed at the Covestro Innovation Rink up at the Lemieux Center, and then we can really test it live, so to say.
Right.
And hopefully, I mean, we really hope that that can make a difference, not only for the NHL teams, but I would say even maybe more important, so also for kids and youth playing hockey. But there is still a lot of testing needs to be done.
Right, and the latter part about that, the kids, because hockey has just boomed over the last maybe two decades in the Pittsburgh area for youth hockey. And, you know, let's face it, they're not as athletically able as the pros are, maybe being able to stop themselves, brace themselves, and maybe they hit into the boards a little too hard.
That is correct, yeah. And the dasherboard is only one of the ways that we, you know, or one of the innovation events that we've had, right? So we've had other ones too, together with the same partners, the Penguins and the CMU, okay? So we'll see. There's a lot of excitement and development there, but stay tuned and we'll see what comes out of that.
Lots of concussions in the NHL, despite the helmets. You're also working on making the goalie helmet safer?
Yeah, that was something that came out of the innovation event we had had last year, and that is also a work in progress now. And we also are working with one of the manufacturers of hockey equipment to see how we can realize some of the ideas that the students coming from CMU that are actually the one that are doing the innovation around this, together with our scientists here. To see how you know, a helmet could look like, right? So there's some ideas, some concepts, and we're trying to realize them now.
We're talking to Covestro Chairman and President Håkan Johnson. As you look to build on the company's portfolio beyond hockey, how important will sustainability be in Covestro's future plans?
Sustainability is a very, very important topic for us. And I would say that, you know, we usually say that innovation and R&D has been part of our DNA since the start of our company. And I'm not only talking about Covestro, but also our mother company, Bayer, where we eventually care where we came from. Mm-hmm. I would say that sustainability has also reached, now we would say it's part of our DNA. And we see that in all aspects. For example, in R&D, we have committed to the 17 UN sustainable development goals.
Right.
For example, we will by 2025 have aligned 80% of our innovation spend alongside those 17 goals, right?
Right. Can adhesives, coatings, plastics, polymers, can they actually be sustainable?
Absolutely.
How so?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, if you look at what are the types of products our materials goes into, a lot of that goes into materials that will help us to, for example, reduce energy by making an electrical vehicle go longer because they are more lightweight, or even you reduce in a traditional car to make them go further on less fuel. Mm-hmm. Our materials also used to make houses more economical from a heating and cooling perspective, or making a refrigerator stay colder with less energy, right? Mm. And so our material certainly helps out with sustainability, but we can also make our materials from more sustainable materials, and we are working on that. For example, we're looking at bio-based products to use as a starting point for our materials, and we're also looking at closing the loop, so to say, where we have a circular economy. So after the lifetime, the normal lifetime, our materials, how we can bring them back into the loop and actually make new materials out of them. Mm. So certainly, you can make our materials from sustainable raw materials, but also our materials are key in making a sustainable world.
Does that idea of sustainability in the manufacturing process, does it differ based on the industry? I mean, can you apply what you learn, say, in the cosmetic sector to what you need in automotive or healthcare?
Yes, if you look at the some of the fundamentals in the chemistry we're doing, the fundamental of what we call building blocks, we use those building blocks in making a product goes into cosmetics or that goes into a car or a house. However, there is certain very specialized knowledge to apply those materials into each of those industries, right? So mm-hmm. you need to know the fundamentals, but then you need to have a deeper knowledge also of the industry itself, right, that you serve.
You became president of the company in 2017?
That's correct, yes.
And chairman just January 1st of this year?
That's correct as well, yeah.
So what keeps you up at night right now? What's the biggest challenge on your mind?
Certainly one challenge we have now is the global economy, the slowdown in the global economy. Covestro, like a lot of other international companies, are certainly affected by how well the machines are running in the world, so to say. And when you see a slowdown, we will notice that as well. Mm-hmm. And we have been affected by the global slowdown coming from, you know, the trade conflicts, or say that slowed down the economy in China, or talk about Brexit. So all, if you want to call them mega events, they affect us as well. And so this uncertainty that we have right now has affected our business as well, right? So the business, you know, how will the business situation look like in 2020? That is certainly one area that we are keeping a close eye on.
Safety, efficiency, sustainability, innovation, we've talked about them all. Stated goals for Covestro, the global company. How do you anticipate Pittsburgh becoming part of that story?
Pittsburgh does not have to become part of it. Pittsburgh has been part of that for the last 60 years. As I said, we put our first stake in the ground out in Robinson Township in about 60 years ago, and Pittsburgh is very supportive of you know, providing the needed workforce to us, and also giving the culture of innovation. And later years also certainly this drive and interest in sustainability, right? So Pittsburgh has been very supportive, and that's what we also, you know, we are trying to give back here to the region, the city as well, right? And mm-hmm. and one of the things we can do that in that decision we took last year, we decided that we're going to buy the site and mm-hmm. remain here for the future.
So 60 years, So how important is Pittsburgh to the future of the company?
As I said, Pittsburgh will be, it will be part of our future. We rely on that we will have talent coming out of the universities area. We are relying on that we will have a dynamic workforce development in general, and also the support of the region from the Southern General Business Development, right?
What can Pittsburgh or its people do to create or inspire here that may help push your company forward?
Well, it can be from an overall perspective, and as I said, being interested in looking out, you know, what's happening out at Covestro, being interested in maybe looking at jobs that we offer, being interested in taking in a career, looking out for a career and in the STEM areas. So make sure that we have enough engineers and so on and so forth.
And do they have to be hockey fans?
Absolutely. That is, not only hockey fans, needs to be Penguins fans.
Håkan Johnson is the president and chairman of Covestro. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. PennDOT is installing devices to enforce speed limits in work zones after a deadly year for crashes. And a conversation with the owner and house band leader of Con Alma about providing Pittsburgh's jazz musicians with a stage to call home. Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, civil rights icon Martin Luther King Jr. was born. No, not in Pittsburgh, but the Atlanta-born pastor made several trips to the Steel City as his fame grew for leading the Montgomery bus boycotts. The first few trips, most of the major papers declined to cover him. But by 1960, King was attracting crowds estimated over 10,000 people. He made a final visit in 1966, espousing nonviolence for not only those in the segregated South, but also Vietnam. King was killed in Memphis 17 months later. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In 2018, the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation recorded 1,804 work zone crashes in the state. Nearly half of those accidents resulted in injuries, as well as 23 fatalities. PennDOT, along with the Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission, has begun a two-month pre-enforcement period for the statewide automated work zone speed enforcement program. Cheryl Moon-Siriani is the District 11 executive for PennDOT, covering Allegheny and Beaver Counties. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Kevin.
This speed enforcement program was established by the legislature. How does it work?
Well, basically, there's going to be, it's actually a vehicle that is going to be stationed within the work zones while workers are present, only while the construction workers are present. And it is going to register all of this speeding, and then it's going to provide that information back to the police, and then anybody who is caught speeding through the work zone will be getting a citation.
Okay. So is it sort of operated automatically? Does that person have to operate it, be there, or is it just turned on and automatically gathers this info?
Well, there'll be people stationed in the work zones while this is operating, yes.
Okay. Will all work zones have the detection devices?
No, mostly you'll be seeing it on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, interstate type projects, or projects that have a lot of traffic, such as, you know, we were thinking possibly the Boulevard of the Allies projects, maybe on the parkways and on the turnpikes. That's where you'll mostly see these at here when they're first being rolled out.
So some of the roadways that tend to have higher speed limits in general?
Higher volumes of traffic, higher speed limits, yes.
So during the pre-enforcement period, now through March 4th, if someone is speeding through a work zone that has one of these devices, they won't get a citation during this period. Will they get some sort of note in the mail saying, hey, buddy, slow down?
I don't believe during the pre-enforcement that's going to occur. I think that's just basically to make sure everything is working accurately and doing exactly what it's intended to do.
So is it as much to help PennDOT sort of get the process going as it is, say, motorists? It's coming.
Yeah, basically, a lot of motorists have seen this. Other states have used it, but it's basically to inform everybody we're serious about this. We take the safety of our workers seriously, and this is how we're going to be handling it from this point forward.
Do you know how effective it's been in other states?
I personally do not. The folks that have studied this for many years and trying to get this implemented could give you facts and figures, but I'm pretty sure, and I believe it's Maryland, it has been very successful.
So will there be any evaluation of how the system is working prior to the official enforcement, which begins March 4th?
Yeah, it's with anything we do at PennDOT. You know, we'll try things, and if they work, this works, that works. We want to make sure everything's working perfectly or very well before we get to March 4th. So I'm sure that's the why we're going through this phase here at the beginning. Mm-hmm.
When the official enforcement begins March 4th, what's going to be the procedure? Do you automatically get a citation if it's the first time? How is that going to work?
Yeah, if the first time you're caught speeding over 11 miles over the work zone speed limit, you will receive a citation in the mail. You'll get a warning for the first time. The second time you're caught speeding, you'll get a $75 fine. And the third time, you'll get a $150 fine. No points will be assessed, just fines at this point.
You think those penalties, shall we say, are stiff enough, considering the consequences?
Well, I don't want anyone to ever get hurt, but I do think they are going to be changing the behavior of the traveling public. You would be surprised at the amount of speeds we see through our work zones.
As, for example?
Well, on 279 North, we were working on that road for the past few years. We had hundreds and hundreds. I'd say we actually have thousands going over the work zone speed limit of 45, but we've actually had hundreds of people going over 80, 90 miles an hour, dozens going over 100 through the work zone at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I mean, this isn't even at night. So there's active workers out there, and folks are speeding feet away from them at 100 miles an hour.
What are you hearing from drivers as they learn about this program that's being introduced? Any feedback about the plan so far?
Well, I haven't heard so much from the drivers. I've heard a lot from the contractors, the construction workers, our maintenance workers. They're very looking forward to this. They hope it changes the behavior. They hope people get off their cell phones and slow down both while they're going through the work zones.
So nothing yet, but when maybe those first tickets happen?
we're certainly hoping, first of all, that it does slow folks down considerably and that they do pay more attention, not just in the work zones where we're going to have these machines set up, but in all of the work zones, they pay more closer attention.
Well, people know where the work zones are. Is there like a website? So in other words, pre-warning?
I think there's a website now notifying across the state of where these are potentially going to be set up. The timing is going to be quite difficult because we might say it's going to be on the Boulevard of the Allies this week, and then it rains for 3 days and there's no construction workers present. We're not allowed to have it active if there's nobody working. So it's going to be tough on what times of the day and what days of the week that'll actually be out there.
And you're not allowed to have it active. Is that part of the legislation that was passed?
Right. Part of the legislation is you actually have to have active workers present. So if they shut off at 3, then the automated work zone enforcement has to shut off at 3. So that's going to be kind of tough with timing and everything.
There have been public service campaigns to try to get drivers to slow down with messaging saying these workers are mothers, fathers, spouses, and yet there are still work zone fatalities. Why do you think this approach to enforcement will be more effective than those public service messages?
Well, when you have to pay a fine, when you actually have to write a check or money comes out of your pocket, we're hoping the next time you're going through a work zone, you don't want to have to spend money out of your pocket again, and you actually pay closer attention to what's happening in the construction work zones. That's the goal. The goal is to save lives, to try to get people to pay closer attention. There's too many of my friends and family who have been hurt, near misses, folks that have been killed. That's really the intention of this.
Are you hopeful?
I'm very hopeful. I'm actually very optimistic. I think, you know, there's only a few going statewide right now. You only see a few across the state. I hope this picks up speed and we'll be able to use them on a lot more work zones once this becomes very effective.
Cheryl Moon Sirianni is PennDOT District 11 Executive. Cheryl, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. With more than 40 jazz events each week, the Pittsburgh region has incubated the careers of artists who are recognized around the world. But in recent years, there has not been a venue devoted entirely to jazz. That changed last year with the opening of Con Alma in Shadyside. Recently, 90.5 WESA's Bob Studebaker spoke with one of the owners, guitarist John Shannon. They began their conversation at the restaurant and finished here in our studios.
All right, so when you walk in the door here, this is our house piano, which is a 1977 Fender Rhodes. And of course, you know, we have great drum kit, you know, a great bass amp, just to make it as easy as possible for the cats to come and play and, you know.
Drummer doesn't have to lug his stuff in to play.
Exactly, exactly. So as we keep going, this whole wall is all Teenie Harris photos that the Carnegie has printed for us. This is the original Crawford Grill. So as soon as you walk in, we're honoring that legacy.
You almost feel like putting your hand over your heart when you say that too, don't you?
Yeah, you do, you do. As we keep going here, you know, Mary Lou Williams. This is one of Sarah Vaughan and some other musicians backstage somewhere. Again, all Teenie Harris. You got Duke and Strayhorn over there. A double exposure of Nina Simone at the Hilton in Oakland in the 60s. And Young Ahmad Jamal. Lastly, before you hit the stairs, check this out. This is young George Benson with his Guild guitar.
Wow.
Yeah, isn't that great? And all these posters, you know, all these, the old school Earl Hines, it's all honoring the Pittsburgh legacy. Of course, over here we have our beautiful bar, you know, and all of our drinks and cocktails. It's all in the spirit of jazz and, you know, named after different standards, you know, in honor of different musicians. And also coming out of the Latin flavor of Con Alma, the Dizzy Gillespie tune, a lot of old Latin favorites, you know, old cocktails and stuff.
Since the band was getting ready to start, and Con Alma is primarily about the music, I invited John into the studio on a different day to finish our conversation. What does it take to make a jazz club? What does a jazz club need to be a good jazz club?
Atmosphere, vibe. That's what it takes. A place where the musicians feel inspired by the space.
And you've got that, you've accomplished that to your satisfaction with Con Alma?
I think so. I think we are accomplishing that, and from the feedback of the musicians and from myself playing there.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask, is, yeah, what kind of feedback you get from the guys who play there.
Yeah. Everybody seems to really love playing there. I mean, I encourage everybody to, when they're playing there, to actually play, to go into the music, to not be concerned about the audience or people, to play and to play long and to play solos. I don't think there's a lot of places in Pittsburgh right now that have that kind of
no, there aren't.
Moral improvisational support, if you will. So, yeah, I think most people enjoy playing at Con Alma, you know.
Let me ask you a little bit about the food aspect, because Con Alma is known as a place to go to get something to eat, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so this is the trifecta of the concept. You know, it's a place where you can get incredible food. Foodies come. Pittsburgh foodies come to check out Josh Ross's menu. You know, Josh is my partner, as well as Amy Marshall, who runs all the drinks and has curated the cocktails and all of that. And people come just for the cocktails as well. As well as the jazz. So people are coming for the jazz, people are coming for the drinks, people are coming for the food. And what you have is an atmosphere that comes together from all these three things. And that supports a big part of my mission, which is to turn people on to jazz again.
As we were walking through Con Alma, you talked about the Teenie Harris photos on the wall and the incredible legacy of jazz in Pittsburgh. But there are a lot of native-born Pittsburghers who aren't aware of how much history was created here and how much of American music was changed because of Pittsburgh artists. And, of course, the newcomers don't necessarily have a chance to be aware of that. So it's nice to be able to educate.
Absolutely. Yeah, I feel a responsibility to shine that light on the Pittsburgh legacy because, you know, Pittsburgh loves to be proud of itself, and this is something to really be proud of. This is something outside of sports to be really proud of as a Pittsburgher. I mean, the impact that this city has had on the formation of jazz music is incredible. And then the multi-generational jazz families of Pittsburgh and the scene now that has come through a lot of that legacy, you know, it's here now as well. That's what's special about the Pittsburgh scene is that it's connected to its past. And you can't say that for other cities.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, because I'm certainly well aware of that here in Pittsburgh.
You are, yeah.
And I see and enjoy third-generation jazz musicians on a continuous and ongoing basis here. But I was curious, is that something that you've noticed in other cities?
No. I mean, obviously, New York City, there's so much going on. It's hard to say it's one way or another. Certainly, there are generational aspects there, but not in such a concentrated way as here in Pittsburgh. And not to mention that the level of the jazz musicians in Pittsburgh is world class. It's on par with any other city in the world. And on top of that, it's its own thing. This deep swinging element, this bluesiness, this just everything that makes Pittsburgh real and authentic, it's still here. And we still have the living legends and the links to the past, such as Roger Humphreys.
Yeah, Frank Cunamondo.
Frank Cunamondo, exactly. On and on. And so many of the musicians who have come through Roger's band, that have come through Jimmy Ponder's band, you know.
Yeah.
That are here now continuing the music and educating and teaching the younger musicians now.
That's that Pittsburgh tradition of passing it on, which is also the name of one of Roger's albums, Pass It On.
Mm.
And that's something integral to jazz in Pittsburgh. It was the subject of a documentary that Billy Jackson made about 5 years ago about Roger called Pass It On,
right,
where he passes it on to young musicians as it was passed on to him. Now, that actually speaks to a collegiality among jazz musicians in Pittsburgh, which is that common in other cities, or is there more of a competitive aspect to it?
Well, it's not common in other places, as far as I understand. But really what it leads me to mention about what's important about Pittsburgh is it's being passed on in a way that you could call street. You know, it's being passed on in a street way, because it's not academic. You know, there is the academic world has so taken over jazz, the over intellectualization of the music, when this music has so much to do with the heart and the street. And Pittsburgh is still that. And I think a lot of the young musicians are picking it up in that way. I mean, I picked it up that way here, coming up under Dwayne Dolphin and Eric Kloss. And so then by the time I went to music school, I was already rooted in that, in the heart of it. And so, you know, I had a choice if I would go into the intellectualization of it or not.
Well, that actually leads into what I wanted to ask a little bit about, is just your personal musical journey. How did you start? Why did you start? When did you start? What was it that motivated you to be a guitarist?
Oh, yeah. Well, since I was really young, I was just taken with music in general. And, you know, by the time I was 6 or 7 years old, I started playing the guitar.
Was it a musical family that you grew up in?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. Yeah. My parents, you know, sang together and played in, you know, wedding stuff back in the day. My grandfather was a jazz drummer. On the other side, my grandfather, Judge Jack O'Brien.
Well, let's stop here so that I can tell everybody who does not know who your other grandfather was, where the Shannon name comes from. If you grew up in Pittsburgh, everybody knows, if you're my age or a little bit younger or a little bit older, the name Paul Shannon.
Yeah.
Paul Shannon's Adventure Time was integral to growing up in Pittsburgh in the 1960s, and then he was on until 75.
Yeah, and he was a great entertainer, and my Uncle Greg was a musician as well, who was in that family line, and my cousin Quinn is here in the city. He's an incredible musical theater singer, and
Well, let's circle back again to Con Alma then. So the place opened up how long ago?
We opened up in June.
And you had a pretty good turnout right away, didn't you? You had a good reception, or was it?
We did. And I think a lot of that is from the words spread quick through the jazz community here.
But you get a lot more than just jazz people, because
that's
a pretty well-populated area, and you get a lot of people from the neighborhood who like to dine out. There are plenty of restaurants near you,
yes.
So you get a lot of people who are coming for the food.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, we have, like I was mentioning before, we have, you know, Pittsburgh foodies coming, people interested in the cocktails and the music, and it really creates this great mix of people, you know, younger, older, black, white, everything in between, you know.
That's something that I've noticed at jazz events, and I've noticed this for decades. Pittsburgh is a balkanized city. We have erected barriers between different groups in the city. But jazz pulls people across all of those boundaries in a way that I think only the Steelers replicate. And of course, the Steelers do it. We're not going to fill up a 60,000-seat stadium for a jazz event.
Right.
Wouldn't that be cool? But still, when you see a jazz event, you see people from all walks of life, all economic aspects of life, all neighborhoods in Pittsburgh, and they come together for a love of the music. And that's a cool thing that you have it there. And that's what you might expect from this most democratic of musical forms.
Exactly. And it makes sense. It's American music.
It's
all-inclusive of everybody. And I want to say that I think one of the special things about Con Alma is that you get to experience live jazz in an intimate setting.
Yeah.
It's not a theater. It's not an unbalanced sonic space. It is a intimate setting where you're right there with the musicians. And, you know, that's a great way to experience and discover jazz music.
And let me ask you just to give a brief explanation of the name Con Alma. I know where it comes from, but...
Yeah, Con Alma, it's a Dizzy Gillespie standard, and we thought it was a great way to kind of tie everything together, because the cuisine is Latin-leaning,
okay.
Josh's cuisine. A lot of the drinks from Amy are based on old Cuban classics,
okay,
and it means with soul.
Yeah.
Our main motivation was to create a place that was hearkening back to the old jazz spots of Pittsburgh, the Crawford Grill, the Hurricane, you know, places and an era when it was about the atmosphere. We don't pressure the audience or our patrons to be quiet during the music, but we also are not telling the band to turn down. It's a whole mixture of the food, the drinks, the music, and, you know, 9 times out of 10, the music does take center stage because, well, we have a stage and we have incredible musicians playing there.
John Shannon, thank you so very much for taking the time to come in and talk about this really nice aspect of Pittsburgh's cultural scene.
Yeah, Bob, thanks for having me, man.
That was WESA's Bob Studebaker with jazz guitarist John Shannon, one of the owners of Con Alma in Shadyside. And for today, that is the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Caldwell Holden and Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.